A country divided, a cutthroat presidential election, and two clarion political voices silenced. A half century later, we look back at the year 1968 on The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. As the Vietnam War split the country, President Lyndon B. Johnson made a stunning announcement.
I shall not seek, and I will not accept, the nomination of my party for another term as your president.
Days later, a civil rights leader, an apostle of nonviolence, was murdered in Memphis.
Good evening. Dr. Martin Luther King, the apostle of nonviolence in the civil rights movement, has been shot to death in Memphis, Tennessee.
And 2 months after that, an assassination of a presidential candidate, moments after he declared victory in a key primary contest.
My thanks to all of you, and now it's on to Chicago, and let's win there. Thank you very much.
Reflecting on the political turbulence and tragedy of 1968, coming up on a special edition of The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike
for president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 222 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. The question has never gone away, and it seems more important than ever, a half century later. What was it about 1968 that made it so important in the nation's and our own consciousness? With two inconceivable assassinations, violence in the streets, a nation torn over war and race, 1968 is certainly not remembered fondly. But it was founded on hope, hope that people could live together in harmony, that the government could work for peace in the world, and equality at home. Is that too much to ask for? Apparently it was. 1968 was a dream that turned into a nightmare. For some, it was a last chance for a nation to live up to its potential. What if Dr. King lived? What if Robert Kennedy didn't walk through that hotel kitchen in Los Angeles? So many what-ifs. It's what keeps the memory of 1968 alive. Those who experienced it will never forget it, and those too young to remember it need to learn the lessons from it. Demonstrations against the war in Vietnam, which was becoming more and more unpopular, were spreading from college campuses to the streets. Tensions between the police and the black community were at a boiling point, with several major cities exploding into violence. And as the riots increased, so did a white backlash. By the summer of 67, President Lyndon Johnson's popularity was on the downswing. Both the Gallup and Harris polls showed him with 39% of the American people approving the job he was doing. A peace candidate, Senator Eugene McCarthy of Minnesota, said he would take on LBJ in the Democratic primaries. McCarthy only got in the race because Robert Kennedy said he wouldn't take on the president, and in fact said he expected to be supporting Johnson in 68. But few saw him as a candidate who could topple LBJ. McCarthy's opposition to the war in Vietnam gave him no choice but to run.
I thought the issues were important enough to the country that one had to run some risk about dividing a party which I thought was already hopelessly divided in any case. I was not only against the war in Vietnam, but since I realized that if anything was going to be done about it, that the challenge had to be laid down to the President of the United States.
Gary Eichten spent about 45 years in an assortment of positions at Minnesota Public Radio. He's retired, kinda, but I don't know if that's how I would describe him. What is the best way to describe him is that he's perhaps the nation's foremost expert on Eugene McCarthy. He watched McCarthy campaign on a growing opposition to the war. Gary Eichten, it's great having you on The Political Junkie.
Well, thanks for having me, Ken.
Well, tell me a little bit about the mood in the country as McCarthy was campaigning in New Hampshire. I mean, it was almost a perfect storm for the McCarthy campaign.
Oh, it sure was. I mean, he touched a nerve. There's no question about it. The country was just deeply split over the war in Vietnam. McCarthy had made the war really his major and perhaps only issue. And, you know, he was given no chance, of course, of unseating the incumbent president, Lyndon Johnson. But feelings were running so raw about the war that people were willing to give him a little, you know, give him an ear, and especially the young people who turned out in mass in support of Eugene McCarthy. And so this long shot, nobody paying any attention, senator challenging the incumbent, all of a sudden, you know, he's getting some real traction. And, of course, we know how that turned out once we get to March of 1968 in the New Hampshire primary.
Well, even before we get to New Hampshire, I mean, as the war was continuing to go badly, Johnson's approval numbers were tumbling. And wherever Johnson went, he was met by anti-war demonstrators. Let me play a little piece of audio that's taken from a documentary about LBJ. This is what Johnson heard almost every time he campaigned. I mean, that was pretty intense stuff.
It really was. And exacerbated then by, you know, at the end of January, just, you know, 6 weeks or so before the New Hampshire primary, Tet Offensive was launched in Vietnam. And this came as a great surprise. We had been told repeatedly by military officials, by the Johnson administration, that there was light at the end of the tunnel. We were winning in Vietnam, just a matter of time. If we just put a few more American boys in there, by golly, we'd be able to win. And all of a sudden, the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong launched a major nationwide offensive in South Vietnam. Retrospect, maybe it was a terrible defeat for the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong, but it sure didn't seem like it at the time to the American people. And that really led to a great concern about what we were doing in South Vietnam and what should we be doing with our political system.
When I think of G. McCarthy, I think less of ambition and more that he was answering a calling.
I think that's absolutely right. You know, I had the opportunity, Ken, to interview Senator McCarthy many, many times in the latter part of his life. And the one thing I kept trying to find out from him is whether or not he actually wanted to be president. And, you know, he kind of bobbed and weaved. I think he said he wanted to be president. But then on the other hand, I'm not sure he actually did, really. But he definitely wanted to influence our policy in Vietnam. I mean, that was just crucial to him. And it was not personal ambition on his part, no.
Now, you mentioned earlier that few people, few if anybody, thought he could win. Did he ever think he could win? Did he ever think that Johnson could be toppled?
I don't think so. I can only speculate. I don't believe, at least early on, he really thought this was possible. I think he saw this as his campaign as a way to bring the issue to the forefront. He wasn't making any progress in the Senate. This was a way to get people's attention, give people a voice, those who were concerned about the war, use his campaign as a vehicle. But I don't think he actually thought this was going to be possible to unseat Johnson. And I don't know this for a fact, but I'm guessing that he was as surprised by what happened in New Hampshire as everybody else was.
Well, there's no question about the kind of commitment that his workers had, his volunteers had, that famous the Clean for Gene group of those former grubby students. But he was also supported by many members of the entertainment field. Let me play a little radio commercial here.
This is Tony Randall. How will you feel? Just stop and think for a moment. How would you feel if you woke up Wednesday morning and found that Eugene McCarthy had won the New Hampshire primary? Wouldn't you feel that suddenly there was new hope for America?
But at the same time, the Democratic establishment was still backing Johnson's war policy, and they would have nothing of it.
The communists in Vietnam are watching the New Hampshire primary. They're They're watching to see if we, here at home, have the same determination as our soldiers, Navy men, and Marines who are fighting in Vietnam. Don't vote for fuzzy thinking and surrender. Support our fighting men.
Gary, do you think that the Viet Cong were sitting and watching the campaign in New Hampshire?
Probably not watching the campaign in New Hampshire, but I'm thinking that they were very cognizant of public opinion in America. And, you know, I mean, they had been at war with the French and the Japanese and, you know, who knows who else for centuries. And I think they realized all they had to do was hang on and that we would go away. And every time they would hear, you know, of the protests and the demonstrations and so on, I think it gave them hope that, by golly, they might be able to outwait us.
And then explain what happened in New Hampshire.
Explain what happened in New Hampshire. Oh, boy. You know, McCarthy was wildly effective. And Johnson, I don't think they really put much style. You know, I think they just said, well, that he's not going to beat our guy. Johnson was pretty confident that he would prevail. Even though people were obviously upset with the war, nobody would unseat an incumbent president in their own party, and that just wasn't going to happen. McCarthy ran a great campaign in New Hampshire, and the people that he brought in, especially the kids, just really worked hard. And, you know, those two commercials that you ran, especially the Tony Randall one, I think really hit it on the mark that people were so concerned about the war, they'd had no real way to express themselves effectively. And here was a chance, you know, like the Randall ad said, you know, just imagine if you'd wake up the next day and he won, we'd finally have made a statement. We'd finally have some hope. That's pretty compelling stuff.
When you think of the result, do you think it was good news for McCarthy, or was it really just bad news for Johnson?
I think mostly it was bad news for Johnson. I mean, because because McCarthy didn't even win, after all. I mean, he came close, and it was kind of a symbolic victory. But it was really a bitter defeat for Lyndon Johnson.
McCarthy didn't get much time to savor the results in New Hampshire.
I am announcing today my candidacy for the presidency of the United States.
Senator Robert Kennedy of New York, who had long insisted he would not run for president, jumped into the race 4 days after a New Hampshire primary that exposed Johnson's weakness.
I do not run for the presidency merely to oppose any man, but to propose new policies.
So Bobby Kennedy gets in, and boy, well, I mean, that just sucked the life out of the McCarthy campaign. It truly embittered Eugene McCarthy and many of McCarthy's supporters. I mean, you know, he had been out there, they had been out there fighting the good fight against Lyndon Johnson, as they saw it, and laid the groundwork, and now in swoops the Kennedys, and he I don't think was ever able to let that go, McCarthy. He just was really upset about that, and I think he felt like he had been betrayed, you know.
And I'm just wondering, I mean, later in the month when Johnson said he wouldn't run again, did McCarthy feel like celebrating, or did Kennedy become the new opponent and he had other things to worry about?
I think Kennedy became the main guy, especially, and this sounds, I want to be careful how I say this, but I think that particularly was true just, 5 days after Johnson announced he wasn't going to run again. Then Martin Luther King is assassinated, and Kennedy gives this overwhelmingly powerful address in Indianapolis, I believe it was, talking to people about the King assassination. And, you know, suddenly Kennedy, with a star power, with the money, was vaulted to the front of he was the challenger, and McCarthy was kind of an afterthought to a good many people.
Did McCarthy see California as the final battle with Bobby Kennedy?
I think so. he had, if I remember right, Ken, I believe McCarthy had actually won the Oregon primary.
Right, the week before, yes.
Right before California. And so although his campaign was clearly on the ropes, McCarthy's campaign, you know, he still won a significant primary leading into the big kahuna there in California. And I think for certain he saw that as a kind of last stand if he was going to continue on as a major force, a major candidate. He was going to have to win in California, and of course he didn't win in California.
It just seemed like the end of the campaign, the end of the McCarthy campaign, losing in California, and of course watching Bobby Kennedy die, and then George McGovern coming in as a Kennedy candidate, and McCarthy into the convention. It just seemed like so much of McCarthy's political life was sapped from him. But he never seemed to be the same. I mean, years later, I think in 1980, he backed Ronald Reagan for president. He just seemed bitter, and it almost seemed like, and I had the honor of the pleasure of interviewing him once many years later, and he still was talking about Bobby Kennedy. I guess that just never went away.
Oh, right. No, he was very upset about how things turned out. The Democrats here in Minnesota was kind of an epicenter because we had at the time our two leading Democrats were running against each other for the presidency of the United States, Hubert Humphrey and Eugene McCarthy, and it split the Minnesota Democrats right down the middle, really ugly. And to this day, there's a lot of people who still haven't kissed and made up. They're still mad at each other for that. A lot of people argue that if McCarthy had shown even a little enthusiasm for Humphrey, Humphrey would have defeated Richard Nixon. But he just couldn't bring himself to do that. And the bitterness, as you say, I mean, it's kind of lingered on for many, many, many years. And even shortly before he died, he was still, I'm convinced, still mad at the Kennedys and people who were not as supportive as he thought they should have been.
Gary Eichten is a former reporter and host for Minnesota Public Radio who had known and covered Eugene McCarthy for many years. McCarthy died in 2005 at the age of 89. Gary, thank you so much for being on the program.
Thanks for having me, Ken.
All we are saying.
President Johnson may have nominally won the New Hampshire primary in 1968, but his showing was a humiliation. He was supposed to win in a rout. He didn't. Johnson 49, McCarthy 42. Far closer than anyone expected. Perception is reality in politics, and the reality was that Johnson didn't do what he needed to do. And then when Bobby Kennedy got into the race, he knew that, for him, the future didn't look promising, and he was running out of alternatives. That was the situation when Johnson decided to address the nation on that final Sunday night in March. I remember sitting down with my parents in front of the television that night. We kind of suspected some big news was about to be made.
Good evening, my fellow Americans. Tonight I want to speak to you of peace in Vietnam and Southeast Asia. No other question so preoccupies our people.
What he had to say was dramatic, an immediate halt to the bombing over North Vietnam.
Our purpose in this action is to bring about a reduction in the level of violence that now exists. It is to save the lives of brave men and to save the lives of innocent women and children. It is to permit the contending forces to move closer to a political settlement.
And then something in his tone changed, and I felt it. And I remember telling my parents something big was coming, and I knew what it was.
I have concluded that I should not permit the presidency to become involved in the partisan divisions that are developing in this political year. With American sons in the field far away, with America's future under challenge right here at home, with our hopes and the world's hopes for peace and the balance every day, I do not believe that I should devote an hour or a day of my time to any personal partisan causes or to any duties other than the awesome duties of this office, the presidency of your country.
And then he said the words.
Accordingly, I shall not seek, and I will not accept, the nomination of my party for another term as your president.
Julian Zelizer is a presidential historian at Princeton University and author of The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress, and the Battle for the Great Society. I spoke with him last year on what led up to Johnson's decision to drop out of the race.
The political situation had turned. The conservative coalition of Southern Democrats and Republicans had regained their strength in the 1966 midterm campaigns. Vietnam was consuming the entire agenda by 1968. He had opponents on the right who said he wasn't tough enough, and opponents on the left who said he was in a war that was unnecessary. And his domestic agenda was stalled. He really wasn't making much progress on the issues he cared about. And he was being pressured by Congress to dramatically cut spending on domestic policy. So going into the new year, everything seemed to be turning the wrong way for this president.
And that had to be a huge disappointment for Johnson, pushing for civil rights and racial equality and watching America's streets burn at the same time.
It did. The riots that take place in the summer of 67 in Detroit and Newark, New Jersey, and also in some other smaller cities were really devastating to him. He couldn't understand why those problems continued and why the legislation that he passed, in his mind, wasn't appreciated enough. And that there was still protest and there was still chaos in his mind even after those gains. So he was incredibly frustrated. He was pushing for an open housing bill, and it stalled in 1966. It stalled in 1967. It stalled, and he was trying to get it through in 68 as the presidential campaign was getting started.
Had Johnson run again, could he, with all the upheaval of 1968, have been renominated? Zelizer thinks yes.
I think Johnson, even in early 68, even with all the problems, I still think he had a chance of defeating them and still of being the best coalitional Democratic candidate to defeat a Republican. And he was very savvy. We can't forget that. You know, in 64, he put together a pretty skillful campaign. And I think he could have gained the nomination. I think he still could have done well against Nixon. And I think just because he stepped out doesn't mean that he should have stepped out or that his loss was inevitable.
We'll never know.
Come gather round, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. And if your breath to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. For the times, they are a-changing.
Compared to what was going on with the Democrats, there was comparatively little drama on the Republican side. Former Vice President Richard Nixon was well-positioned to win the nomination. Some of it was simple luck. One of his top challengers, Michigan Governor George Romney, basically self-destructed with this comment in a September 1967 TV interview.
Well, you know, when I came back from Vietnam, I just had the greatest brainwashing that anybody can get.
By the generals?
When you go over to Vietnam, well, not only by the generals, but also by the diplomatic corps over there.
On its surface, the comment made sense. But Romney never recovered from the ridicule of talking about being brainwashed, and he was out of the race by February, before we even got to the New Hampshire primary. Nelson Rockefeller, the governor of New York, had teased about getting into the race after the withdrawal of Romney, but while he kept hinting yes, he kept saying no. One of his strongest supporters, the new governor of Maryland, a guy by the name of Spiro Agnew, was so frustrated by Rocky's failure to follow through that he publicly blasted the New York governor and endorsed Nixon. Nixon, who was seen as surly during his last campaign, a losing race for governor of California, where he promised that the press wouldn't have him to kick around anymore, had transformed into something few thought possible. He became, to many voters, likable. Whether it was a 2-second cameo on the TV show Laughin',
Sock it to me,
or his new friendliness on the campaign trail, it was, as people said at the time, a new Nixon. He smiled a lot.
As we begin to meet you, we're just so delighted to be here and to find that you put on such a warm California day for us. And so that you know who we are, I think you will know Pat, my wife, of course, and this is Julie, and this is Patricia. And we'll be delighted to meet all of you. We hope you can all stay so that we can greet you personally. Thank you very much.
But his ultimate message was a call for new leadership.
There has been a lot of criticism of President Johnson. Some of it justified, much of it petty and unjustified. There are those that don't like his accent. And there are those that don't like his style. And there are others that don't think he comes over too well on TV. I know how he feels. But my friends, the issue in 1968 is not the Johnson personality, but the Johnson policies. And I say, whether you look at America's record abroad or at home, this is not a time to continue with Lyndon Johnson. It's time for new leadership under a Republican president and a Republican administration.
It was a message that appealed to Gordon Durnall. Gordon was a former Republican chair of the state of Indiana back in 1968. He was the executive director of the Nixon for President campaign in the Hoosier State. Gordon, welcome to the Political Junkie.
Glad to be here.
What was it about Nixon that appealed to you the most? I mean, was it personality? Was it ideology? Was it looking for a winner? What did Gordon Durnall see in Richard Nixon?
Yeah, I just gone through the Goldwater years when we had a book out that said winning isn't everything, and I thought it was. So I got called conservative Uncle Tom by Stan Evans in the Indianapolis News and so forth. But we're going with Nixon. No, he was a good, solid guy. Nobody had a better grasp of the issues. You could sit in a room with him, and he could tie the whole world together, every country, of how an issue played there and how it played somewhere else. And it was amazing sitting in a room and listening to him.
You were talking about sitting in a room with Nixon. Obviously, Indiana was one of the big primary states of 1968, although on the Republican side, Nixon ran unopposed. Richard Nixon, spend much time in Indiana, and did you get to see him and talk to him much?
Not right at the primary time, but we did get to see him and talk to him quite a bit. He was here early in 68 he was here, but he was helping us and raise money and so forth. So we got to see him quite a bit in Washington or down in Florida for the convention. And one of the things that I always remember that I thought was funny, if you're talking about his personality changing, we would meet every morning at 8 a.m., and each state would go through where their delegates were and what the count was. And there were a couple of guys running against him. I forget the guy's name that ran so many times, but he was still relatively young then.
You mean Harold Stassen?
Yes, Stassen, yes. He was in there, and he was getting some votes. But anyway, we were counting votes every morning. And Nixon would come in and try to joke. We were all males, obviously, at that time. He would come in and try to joke with us about, you know, are you getting along with the girls down here while your wives are home, those kind of things. And he could never pull it off. It never sounded real. It's like he had this thing to say when he came in that somebody gave him, Ed Rollins or somebody, and he couldn't pull it off. So he wasn't quite as loose as he'd come across. But, yeah, Indiana was maybe, I don't know how many primaries we had then, maybe 10, something like that. And the following Indiana primary was Oregon and California, and it was over.
Right, Nebraska, then Oregon, right.
Yeah. What he wanted to do was set a record, and he was unopposed. And we had all these county chairmen, county clerks out there not putting unopposed candidates on the ballot. And it was really a big, big effort to get his name on every county ballot so that we could break the record, and we did. I forgot what the vote was. Maybe it was 500 and some thousand. But anyway, we broke up just by a few thousand votes. So he went to the next states, and we just broke the record in Indiana. That was the goal that John Mitchell had for us and so forth. And it was kind of tough to pull off, but we did it.
You mentioned John Mitchell. Of course, we remember him from other things and during Watergate. But what was John Mitchell's role in 1968, and what was your relationship with John Mitchell in 68?
He's the guy we talked to the most. He was kind of the director. I forget what his exact title was. But we met with him a lot. And then in the next campaign, we would go to the Justice Department and meet with him a lot. But we took him as a good, solid guy that we could work out a decent plan with.
The fact that Nixon ran unopposed on the Republican side in Indiana, and with all the attention on the Democratic side with Kennedy and McCarthy, and actually Governor Roger Branigan was running as the Lyndon Johnson stand-in, with all that excitement and enthusiasm on the Democratic side, what did you have to do to make sure Republicans weren't lulled to sleep by a lack of a contest?
Well, the first thing we had to do was get him on the ballot in each county, and that was the major task of the primary for us. But we had callers. We had people knocking on doors. We had the whole thing going.
Did you ever talk to him about how the campaign was going? Did you ever talk to him about the decision to pick Spiro Agnew as his running mate? I mean,
no, because we were promoting Richard Lugar for vice president, and we thought we were going to get that done, and Agnew kind of came out of the blue to us. So.
And back then, Richard Lugar was the mayor of Indianapolis.
Yes, right.
And speaking of Republicans from Indiana that year, one of the Senate candidate against Birch Bayh was William Ruckelshaus. And, of course, Ruckelshaus had a different relationship with Nixon when he was a deputy attorney general.
Yeah, he ended up being one of the fired guys during that whole thing. But I was on a commission or a committee. There were six of us, and our job was to get to the people in our states and around our states who were top businessmen and so forth. And the real purpose was to line up contributors for the next campaign. And I always remember the night that Ruckelshaus called me and said, probably a good time for me to resign from that commission because the Watergate folks were looking at it. So I resigned and got out of there. But Ruck was, our main guy. I mean, here in Indiana, we were really pushing for him, and that didn't work out.
Well, no, it was a close race. You had Ruckelshaus for senator. You had Ed Whitcomb for governor. For the most part, they were Republican landslides. You've been involved in politics, I guess, since 1960. That's fair, right?
Yeah, maybe a little before that.
How would you compare Nixon to other Republican presidential candidates he worked for? And I'm not talking about in retrospect. I'm not saying thinking back what he did with Watergate. But at the time, Nixon as a candidate in 1968, how would you compare him to other candidates?
The thing about Nixon was he was extremely bright. I mean, he had all this stuff in his head, and he knew exactly what he needed to do to win. And he had that laid out, and he had a guy like John Mitchell who was similar. Type of guy, a little better personality, maybe. But Nixon knew what the hell was going on, and he knew how to deal with it. So when you sit down with him, he would lay out this big plan and pursue that plan. So.
Do you remember the last time you spoke to Richard Nixon?
Last time I spoke to Richard Nixon, I don't think I spoke with him after he resigned, after all the Watergate stuff. So it would have been before that.
And do you remember any conversations? I mean, did you speak to him towards the end, or?
No, I had no conversations with him about Watergate, I don't think. I was often in the campaign headquarters, and I was assigned beside Indiana. I was assigned to do a little bit in Missouri and a little bit in New Jersey, where they didn't think we had much of a chance in New Jersey. They just wanted somebody to come in every once in a while and oversee the guy there. But and I was at the headquarters a lot and saw him, you know, several times during the campaign. But I may not have seen him after the campaign, personally.
So when we're looking for people to blame for Watergate, we shouldn't blame Gordon Durnall, correct?
Well, no, Watergate was going, it was going on that whole time, you know. So, but I did. I mean, I was in the headquarters, and they would, some of those guys would open the drawer and show me all these $100 bills and all the cash, and I would say, you know, I've been around politics long enough to know that's going to get you in trouble. And it's all, no, it's all legal and everything. Well, they were trying to avoid the new law.
And it was all legal until they got caught, right?
That's exactly it, yeah.
Gordon Durnall is a longtime Republican official and strategist from Indiana. In 1968, he was the executive director of Richard Nixon's campaign in the Hoosier State. Gordon, thank you so much for being on the program.
You bet. Thank you.
Think about it. Who is the one man who has the experience and the qualifications to lead America in these troubled, dangerous times? Nixon's the one.
Nixon's the one. Nixon's the one. Nixon's the only one. We believe in Nixon. And I act so well. Nixon's the only one.
President Johnson's decision not to seek re-election was a personal tragedy for him, of course. But for many in the Democratic Party, it was a time to start fresh. The war in Vietnam was a mess, and race relations in the country were poor. There was an opportunity for change. Good things were coming. That sentiment didn't last long. Just 4 days after LBJ's speech to the nation came this, as told by CBS's Walter Cronkite.
Good evening. Dr. Martin Luther King, the apostle of nonviolence in the civil rights movement, has been shot to death in Memphis, Tennessee.
The nightmare of 1968 was only just getting started.
Dr. King was standing on the balcony of a second-floor hotel room tonight when, according to a companion, a shot was fired from across the street. In the friend's words, the bullet exploded in his face. Police, who have been keeping a close watch over the Nobel Peace Prize winner because of Memphis' turbulent racial situation, were on the scene almost immediately. They rushed the 39-year-old Negro leader to a hospital where he died of a bullet wound in the neck.
Dr. King had been in Memphis on behalf of striking sanitation workers. Just the night before he was killed, he had this to say.
Maybe I could understand the denial of certain basic First Amendment privileges because they haven't committed themselves to that over there. But somewhere I read of the freedom of assembly. Somewhere I read of the freedom of speech. Somewhere I read of the freedom of press. Somewhere I read that the greatness of America is the right to protest for right.
The nation obviously went into immediate mourning. President Johnson here expressed his grief.
America is shocked and saddened by the brutal slaying tonight of Dr. Martin Luther King. I ask every citizen to reject the blind violence that has struck Dr. King, who lived by nonviolence.
One of the most memorable and heart-wrenching speeches of the year was heard that night in Indianapolis. Bobby Kennedy, campaigning in the Hoosier State ahead of the May 7th primary, announced the news of the assassination to a crowd of mostly African Americans who had come to hear him speak. He had no notes. He was speaking from the heart.
I have some very sad news for all of you, and that is that Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis. Martin Luther King dedicated his life to love and to justice between fellow human beings. He died in the cause of that effort. In this difficult day, in this difficult time for the United States, it's perhaps well to ask what kind of a nation we are. and what direction we want to move in. For those of you who are black, considering the evidence evidently is that there were white people who were responsible, you can be filled with bitterness and with hatred and a desire for revenge. We can move in that direction as a country in greater polarization, black people amongst blacks and white amongst whites, filled with hatred toward one another. Or we can make an effort, as Martin Luther King did, to understand and to comprehend and replace that violence, that stain of bloodshed that is spread across our land, with an effort to understand, compassion, and love.
Larry Tye is the author of Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. Larry, it's a pleasure to welcome you back to The Political Junkie.
Great to be back on with you.
You know, I listened to that the Bobby speech in Indianapolis, and of course, my mind goes back to 1968. And as you wrote in your book, and by the way, your book is just so outstanding. I just say that every time I speak to you, but it's a wonderful, wonderful book. But that has to be one of the signature moments of Bobby Kennedy's career, that speech in Indianapolis.
Yes. So was probably the best speech that he ever delivered. And what was most compelling about it is when he arrived at the airport after a full day of campaigning that night, he shows up at the airport in Indianapolis. He's greeted by the mayor, the young mayor of Indianapolis, who would go on to become a very old senator, Richard Lugar. And Lugar tells him about King's assassination and says, "You will not go in tonight and deliver this speech in the ghetto, because if you do, you might not come out alive, and if you do, you will create a riot." And Bobby Kennedy listened dutifully and proceeded to ignore Lugar's advice and went in to the ghetto, tore up the notes that his young aides had given him, and for those 5 minutes, the 5 minutes that you played the excerpt from, he delivered what may have been the best speech that a white politician has ever delivered to a black audience, and maybe than any politician has ever delivered. And it was partly the emotion of the moment, and it was partly a reflection of just how far Bobby Kennedy had come in his own political growth and maturation, that he could go in there that night and try to embrace the African-American community for the loss of Martin Luther King. And the miracle was, by the end of the evening, they were embracing him for the loss 5 years before of Jack Kennedy. That night was the first time that Bobby Kennedy ever in public talked about what it felt like to lose his brother. And even then, he couldn't name his brother. He couldn't say Jack. The closest he could come is by saying, "I lost a member of my family."
The relationship of Bobby Kennedy and his brother as well with the African-American community, with the civil rights community, with civil rights as an issue, that was always a question with the Kennedy brothers.
It was a question. It was a question that was an appropriate question for the black community to be asking. Bobby Kennedy started out his attorney generalship in 1961 as one of the most clueless people on civil rights who was out there. He had grown up in Hyannisport and in Palm Beach, two lily white places, not contact with African Americans, not contact with civil rights. The Kennedys' biggest worry at the start of their administration was that the black community would do something to embarrass Jack before he went off in his summit with Nikita Khrushchev. That was who Bobby was when he started. Who he was in the speech that you just played from Indianapolis was who he was near the end of his life. From that moment in Indianapolis through the rest of Bobby's campaign in 1968, I think I can say without any hyperbole that Bobby was the singly most popular white man in black America. And from that moment on, any time he campaigned in a black audience, you would see somewhere in that audience a little sign turn up, and the sign said, "White, but all right." And that may not sound like much 50 years later, but for a black community in an era of the kind of racial turmoil there was 50 years ago, to say that about any white politician was something extraordinary.
And I guess it's not hyperbole to say that in some ways that speech that Kennedy gave that night in Indianapolis perhaps saved that city from going into the turmoil we saw other cities go through in the aftermath of the King shooting.
So in more than 100 cities that night across America, in just about every city with a sizable black population, there was a riot. In the city of Washington, D.C., a chunk of the city was burned down that night and took decades to rebuild. And in Indianapolis, when Bobby Kennedy asked people to go home and say a prayer for Martin Luther King and for America, enough people did that, that even though people had come, we know years later, that they had come armed with Molotov cocktails and knives, there was no violence.
Earlier in this program, we heard from Bobby Kennedy when he announced his candidacy for president 4 days after the New Hampshire primary, 4 days after Eugene McCarthy did better than expected and Lyndon Johnson got an embarrassment. But when I think of Kennedy in Indianapolis, I think of his compassion and I think of his sensitivity in his speech. But those are two things that people said Kennedy was lacking when he jumped into the race after New Hampshire.
So when Bobby jumped into the race 4 days after McCarthy showed how vulnerable Lyndon Johnson was, the number one word that people used, including reporters all across America, was the word ruthless.
I think of that word today. He was ruthless, right?
Ruthless. And in fact, Murray Kempton, the columnist, wrote a telegram to Ted Kennedy that captured the spirit of the rest of the press. He said that your brother's entry into the New Hampshire primary or into the presidential nomination fight showed that St. Patrick didn't drive all the snakes out of Ireland. Not exactly the way you want to be greeted when you're opening a campaign. And that was only topped by the fact that Lady Bird Johnson's press secretary had a line which I thought was almost as good as Kempton's, and she said, it took you 20 years to come out against McCarthy, in reference to the fact that Bobby's first job was with Joe McCarthy, and then you picked the wrong McCarthy. And yet the truth is that exactly 9 days before the New Hampshire primary, Bobby Kennedy was telling reporters he trusted, along with family and friends, I am going to run, but I'm not going to announce before the primary because Gene McCarthy has been in those snowy hills in New Hampshire campaigning for months, and he deserves an open shot at LBJ in New Hampshire, and then I'll come in.
Oh, my goodness. Well, actually, the relationship between Kennedy and McCarthy was not that good to begin with, and that goes back to at least the 1960 convention, right?
Yes.
I do remember, though, at this 1960 Democratic convention, when it was clear that Jack Kennedy was going to win the nomination on the first ballot, Gene McCarthy, I think, gave the nominating speech for Adlai Stevenson, who was seeking the nomination for the third time, and that had to put tension and bad feelings between the Kennedy and McCarthy camps.
Yes, and the Kennedys, and especially Bobby Kennedy, never forgot a slight like that. And so the chance to come and beat McCarthy for the Democratic nomination the way that I think that Bobby would have done in 68 was very sweet revenge.
You know, going back to that speech he gave in Indianapolis, every time I think of it, every time I watch him give that speech, tears well up. And I think because of for all the talk of violence, for all the talk of trying to keep the country together, for all the words of hope, Kennedy himself falls victim to gunshots just 2 months later. And I just can't, that just doesn't escape my thoughts when I watch Kennedy in Indianapolis.
So that speech brings together three of our most painful moments from the 1960s. One is Bobby harking back to the death of his brother Jack, and it is so clearly, in the words that he uttered that night, still an amazingly painful wound that he hasn't gotten over. And the second is losing Martin Luther King and Bobby summoning up the nation's sense of outrage and despair. And the third is, as you say, it's a premonition of what was going to happen to Bobby a couple months later. And I think Bobby understood better than anybody that just how vulnerable he was to an assassin's bullet, because after Jack was killed, Bobby would always go around and say, it should have been me.
Bobby Kennedy had to know that California was going to decide the nomination one way or the other.
Sadly, the night of the California primary, which was Bobby's greatest political victory, we know what happened that night. But what many people don't realize is the last words that Bobby said before he left that platform at the Ambassador Hotel after delivering his victory speech, his last words were, "On to Chicago." And what I think most of America thought that he meant was, "On to the summer convention in Chicago." What he actually meant was the next day he was due to make a trip to Chicago and to meet with what may have been the most powerful figure in the Democratic Party back then, Mayor Richard Daley. And Daley's son, Bill Daley, who was Obama's chief of staff, tells us 50 years later that his dad was almost certain that next day to endorse Bobby Kennedy for president. And if Hubert Humphrey had faced this endorsement by the ultimate insider, Richard Daley, which could have set off a wave of endorsements by other powerful figures, and Humphrey had never actually entered himself one primary, never won one vote, I think what would have happened is Daley would have endorsed, Bobby would have won in Chicago, the Democratic ticket would have been formed the way Democrats and Republicans formed tickets back then, which were the top two people in the party. The ticket would have been Bobby Kennedy and Hubert Humphrey. And I can assure you that Richard Nixon understood better than anybody in America that the person in America who best understood Nixon's vulnerabilities was the guy who 8 years before had run his brother Jack's successful campaign against Nixon. Nixon was worried about Bobby. I think Bobby and Humphrey, without the shadow of riots in Chicago, would have been an astoundingly strong ticket, and that they would have been the winning ticket in 1968.
Let me play part of his Bobby Kennedy's last speech.
So I thank all of you who made this possible this evening, all of the effort that you made, and all of the people whose names I haven't mentioned, but who did all of the work at the precinct level, who got out the vote, who did all of the effort, brought forth all of the effort that's required. I was a campaign manager 8 years ago. I know what a difference that kind of an effort and that kind of commitment makes. So I thank all of you. Those of you who are here. Mayor Yorty has just sent me a message that we've been here too long already. So my thanks to all of you, and now it's on to Chicago, and let's win there. Thank you.
You know, Larry, it's one of those what-ifs of 1968 that we can never get past, because within minutes of Bobby's victory speech, he was shot. And then the next day, there was this announcement by Kennedy Press Secretary Frank Mankiewicz.
Senator Robert Francis Kennedy died at 1:44 a.m. today, June 6, 1968. With Senator Kennedy, at the time of his death, were his wife, Ethel, his sisters, Mrs. Stephen Smith, and Mrs. Patricia Lawford, brother-in-law, Mr. Stephen Smith, and his sister-in-law, Mrs. John F. Kennedy. He was 42 years old.
Larry Tye, it's 50 years later, and it still hurts.
It does still hurt. And one of the horrible, there were a million tragedies, as we all know, in the Kennedy family generally. One of the ironic things about what happened that night at the Ambassador Hotel, and one of the tragic things, is that the only time during that campaign that Bobby's one armed security guy wasn't with him was when he went into the kitchen that night from the stage at the Ambassador Hotel. Bill Berry, an ex-FBI agent, had been with Bobby forever, and the only reason he wasn't at his side going into the kitchen was because Bobby told him to stay behind and help a pregnant Ethel get off the stage. And Berry has never, 50 years later, forgiven himself for not being there. Whether he could have done anything is very unclear. The shooter, Sirhan Sirhan, was a close range, but just one of the many horrible things that happened that night is that Bobby was essentially unprotected.
Larry Tye is the author of what is by far the best book on RFK I've ever read. It's called Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. Larry, I guess every time I speak to you, I tear up or get sad, but I really appreciate having you on the program.
So it was wonderful to be with you again. Thank you.
A postscript. I was a senior in high school that June in the Bronx, about to graduate. I was, even back then, a political junkie. What really captivated me that night, where my attention was focused, was the Republican primary for the Senate from California between incumbent Thomas Kuchel, a liberal, and Max Rafferty, his conservative challenger. It was a contest that was being watched as a key indicator for which way the Republican Party was headed, the battle for the soul of the GOP. The night of the primary, I had set my clock radio for 3 a.m. Eastern Time. I was obsessed with Kuchel versus Rafferty. To this day, I remember it so clearly. I woke up at 3 a.m. I heard the inconceivable words, "The senator has been shot." My first reaction, "Someone shot Thomas Kuchel?" I really remember that. It was not long after that when I realized what had actually happened. It was Bobby Kennedy. I sat on my bed in shock. My next thought, how long do I have to wait to wake up my parents and tell them? I waited until about 6 a.m. or so. "Kennedy was shot," I said to them. My mother looked up. "Bobby?" she said in disbelief. A half century later, it still feels unreal.
Someday, soon, it's gonna be one day. I thought I saw him walking up over the hill, Abraham and Martin and John.
Of course, there's so much more to remember from 1968 than we can possibly fit into a single program. You can find out more about all of the episodes in our series, 1968, 50 Years Later, on our website, krpoliticaljunkie.com. While you're there, be sure to subscribe to our podcast and our weekly email newsletter. If you've got comments or questions, send an email to ken@krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you could follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening.